This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, Michelle Alexander with The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Racial profiling was chosen as the target of this year's Father's Day silent march to end stop and frisk, a discriminatory police practice in New York City that nets more than a half million black and Latino youth each year and is vigorously defended by Mayor Michael Bloomberg. But New York is not the only place where the criminal justice system relentlessly targets people of color for disproportionate surveillance, arrest, and incarceration. In California, prison construction has expanded at record levels ever since the 1970s to incarcerate a rapidly growing proportion of blacks, Latinos, and others of color. According to Ohio State Law professor Michelle Alexander, this is no accident, but part of a racial and caste-based system of social control operating throughout the United States. Alexander refers to this in her new book as The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Alexander recently spoke in Dominguez Hills, California, about the reinstitutionalizing of the Jim Crow syndrome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And it is just wonderful to be here. I'm thrilled that there are so many of you here dedicated to having meaningful conversation about this system of mass incarceration, a system that California as a state has been leading the way in building, a system that truly has decimated so many of our communities, so many of our families, and turn back the clock on racial progress in the United States. This gathering is very timely, given that California is now gripped in debate about how to achieve so-called realignment and how to downsize our prisons somewhat in light of the economic crisis and the near bankruptcy in which the state finds itself. And this fiscal crisis creates a moment of opportunity where people across the political spectrum are suddenly willing to have a conversation about mass incarceration in this massive prison state that has been constructed over the past 40 years. And this is a true moment of opportunity when people are listening. But with opportunity also comes some peril. It remains to be seen, I think, whether those of us who claim to care about racial justice will truly rise to the challenge this moment in history presents. I think the question that is facing us at this time is whether we are going to just tinker with this machine, whether we're going to settle for piecemeal policy reforms, or whether we are going to insist on a revolution of values, a moral revolution, a revolution that will undo the foundation of this system of mass incarceration and ensure that no new caste-like system is ever born again in America. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. once said there is, quote, nothing more tragic than to sleep through a revolution. And he was talking at that time about a profound moral revolution that was underway, a struggle for the recognition of the dignity and value of all humankind, a struggle to end America's caste system known as Jim Crow. And he told an audience the story of Van Winkle, who fell asleep for 20 years. And when he began his extended nap, a sign at a nearby inn had a picture of King George III emblazoned on it. When Rip Van Winkle awoke 2 decades later, the sign had a picture of George Washington on it. And Dr. King told the audience that what was most striking about Rip Van Winkle was not that he had slept for 20 years, but that he had slept through a revolution. He said, quote, "There are all too many people who, in some great period of social change, fail to achieve the new mental outlooks that the new situation demands." I think his words are as relevant today as they were back then. Many of us, myself included, slept through a revolution, actually a counter-revolution, a counter-revolution that blew back so much of the progress that Dr. King and countless other advocates risked their lives to achieve. This revolution has occurred with barely a whimper of protest, and it has successfully relegated millions of people, primarily poor folks of color, to a permanent second-class status, stripping them of the basic civil and human rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. While many of us have been asleep, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged, one that would certainly have Dr. King turning in his grave today. One day, I think we may look back and wonder how we could have possibly slept for so long. I now believe that this system of mass incarceration, this system which shuttles poor kids from decrepit, underfunded schools to brand new high-tech prisons, this system that locks people into a permanent second-class status for life, I believe this system is the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, as I admit in my book, and as I regularly remind folks when I talk about this, I didn't always think this way. I was asleep, even as someone who claimed to care about racial justice. I was asleep. There was a time when I rejected comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery and mass incarceration and Jim Crow and felt folks who were making those kinds of claims and comparisons were distorting things, exaggerating things, blowing it all out of proportion. I viewed the millions cycling in and out of our prisons and jails as just sort of the natural consequence of poverty, bad schools, broken homes. And I wanted to do something about it as a civil rights lawyer and advocate, someone who claimed to care, but I could not see what was hidden in plain sight. I could not see that we didn't simply have an underclass in America. We had an undercast, a group of people who were locked into a permanent second-class status by law. It took a while. It took years of working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate, representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality, and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement, and attempting to assist people who had been released from prison, re-enter to society, but having one door after another slammed in their face, legally by law, that I finally slowly began to have my awakening. And there's one young man in particular who helped to finally open my eyes. He was a young African-American man about 19 years old who walked into my office one day and forever changed the way I viewed this system and myself and my own role in it. At the time, I was directing the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California, and we had launched a major campaign against racial profiling known as the DWB campaign, or the Driving While Black or Brown campaign. And we had already sued the California Highway Patrol for racial profiling and their drug interdiction program, but we were looking to sue some other police departments in California as well, places where we had heard about discriminatory policies, practices, tactics by the police. And so we created a hotline number for people to call if they believe they've been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. We called it the DWB hotline number. And we put up this hotline number on billboards in Oakland, San Jose, other cities around California, urging people to call if they believe they've been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And actually, the first night we announced the hotline number on the evening news, we were flooded with calls. Thousands of people called the hotline. Our system crashed. We had to expand the capacity of the system to manage the flow of calls. And so I was spending my day interviewing one young black or brown man after another who had been stopped, searched, sometimes brutalized by the police for no apparent reason other than race. And it was getting late in the day, and I was tired. I had interviewed a lot of people that day. I was getting tired, and this young man walks into my office with a stack of papers about this thick. He had taken detailed notes of his encounters with the police over about a 9-month period of time. He had documented every stop, every search, every frisk, every time his car was pulled over. He had documented with a description of every encounter. He had names of officers. In some cases, he had badge numbers. He had names of witnesses, people who saw what happened and corroborate. An unbelievable amount of documentation in detail. And the stories he was telling me about what was happening in his neighborhood in Oakland were corroborated by many of the other stories that we'd heard coming out of his neighborhood. So I started to get excited, thinking, I found our dream plaintiff. This is the one we've been looking for. You know, and top it off, he was a really good-looking young man. He was good-looking, photogenic, you know, well-spoken, and I thought, here's the one. He will be our named plaintiff in our suit against the Oakland Police Department. I'm getting excited, asking him more questions. Finally, he says something, though, that makes me pause, and I was like, what? He's like, what did you just say? Did you just say you're a drug felon? And he gets quiet for a minute. He's looking down at the table. And then he just looks right at me, right in my eyes, and he says, yeah, I'm a drug felon, but let me tell you what happened. Let me tell you, the police planted drugs on me. They beat up me and my friend. He starts telling me this big, long story about how he was framed. The police sent him up. The police planted drugs on him and his friend, and you know, the only reason why he took the plea is because he was scared of going to prison. They told him if he just pled out, he'd just get probation. But now he's got a felony. He can't get a job. And I was, I am sorry. I'm sorry. I cannot represent you if you have a felony record. We are screening people. Felony records. People call our hotline. We'd send a form to them to fill out, asking them a bunch of questions about their experiences with the police. One of them was, have you ever been convicted of a felony? We were asking people about their prior criminal history because we believed we couldn't represent someone in a racial profiling case as the named plaintiff in a racial profiling case if they had had a felony record, because we knew if they were our lead plaintiff, the media, law enforcement would be all over us saying, well, of course the police should be keeping their eye on him. He's a drug felon. What do you think? We knew we couldn't put him on the stand without him being cross-examined for an hour about his prior criminal history in front of the jury, undermining his credibility and, you know, taking the jury's attention off of what the police did and making it all about him and his criminal history. And so we had been screening people with prior criminal records, and he had not metaphorically checked the box. And so I was like, I am sorry. Cannot represent you. I am sorry. We cannot. He keeps trying to explain, give me more details about how he was framed, the police planted drugs. I'm sorry. And then he gets enraged, and he tells me, you're no better than the police. You're no better than the police. The minute I tell you I'm a felon, you just stop listening. Can't even hear what I have to say. It's like, what's to become of me? What's to become of me? I can't get a job anywhere because of my felony record. I can't get a job anywhere. I can't even get housing. I can't even get into public housing because of my felony record. I haven't anywhere to sleep. I have to sleep in my grandma's basement at night because because nowhere else will take me in. Because I can't even get food stamps. How am I supposed to feed myself? How am I supposed to take care of myself as a man? He says, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet. They've gotten to us all already. He snatches those papers, all those notes, detail notes, off the desk, just starts ripping them up, tiny little pieces, throwing them in the air, just snowing white paper in the air, and he walks out yelling at me, you're no better than the police. I can't believe I trusted you. He takes off. Well, several months after that, I'm doing a public access television show that's broadcasting live out of his neighborhood. I'm doing public access TV because we were trying to organize several thousand people to go to protest then Governor Davis's refusal to sign racial profiling legislation. And we had been holding town hall meetings up and down the state, and we were doing this public access TV show a couple days before the big demonstration, trying to urge people to get on the bus and go to the state capitol and attend this big demonstration. And so I'm doing this public access TV show, broadcasting live out of his neighborhood. The minute the show goes off the air, he comes bursting into the studio, carrying this dirty potted plant. And he's all emotional, practically on the verge of tears. He's all shaken up, comes rushing up to me, and he says, I'm just here to tell you I'm sorry. I'm sorry for how I treated you. I've been watching you on the news. I've been seeing you on TV. I see you out there trying to fight for our people, trying to do the right thing, and I just wanted to come and just tell you I'm sorry. It's like, I would have bought you some flowers, but I just don't have any money. I snatched this plant off my grandma's front porch. Here. He just hands it to me. And then he turns around and runs out. I go chasing after him. He jumps into this broke down car and takes off. Well, several months after that, I'm in my office. I open up the newspaper. What's on the front page? Oakland Riders police scandal is broken. Turns out that a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, been planting drugs on suspects, beating folks up in his neighborhood, who's identified as one of the main officers accused of having planted drugs on suspects and beating folks up? Officer he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him and beat up him and his friend. And it was really only then, I'm embarrassed to admit, that the light bulb finally went on for me. And I thought to myself, he's right about me. I'm no better than the police. The minute he told me he was a felon, I just stopped listening. I couldn't even hear what he had to say. And that was really the beginning of my journey of asking myself some hard questions of myself as a civil rights lawyer. How am I a part of the problem? How am I actually replicating the very forms of discrimination and marginalization and exclusion I'm supposedly fighting against? And I start also asking myself, why is it, really, that we haven't been able to find one young black man in his neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet? What is really going on? So that was the beginning of me doing a tremendous amount of research, asking myself and others a lot of hard questions, and listening more carefully to the stories of those cycling in and out of the criminal justice system. And what I ultimately learned in that process was that my real crime wasn't in refusing to represent an innocent man. My real crime was in imagining that there was some path to racial justice that did not include the voices, stories, and experiences of those we view as guilty. And I also learned some facts that blew my mind. In the course of my research, I learned there are more African-American adults under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. I learned that as of 2004, more black men were disenfranchised. Then in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, of course, during the Jim Crow era, poll taxes and literacy tests operated to keep black folks from the polls. Well, today, felon disenfranchisement laws in many states now accomplish what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. I learned a black child born today has less of a chance of being raised by both parents than a black child born during slavery. And this is due in large part to the mass incarceration of black men. There was an article published about this in The Economist magazine, of all places, entitled "How the Mass Incarceration of Black Men Harms Black Women." And in the article, it explained that the majority of black women in the United States are unmarried, including about 70% of professional black women, and that this is due in large part to the mass incarceration of black men, which not only takes them out of the dating pool, the years they would be most likely to commit to a partner, to a family, but what's worse is that by branding them criminals and felons at young ages, often before they're even old enough to vote, they're rendered permanently unemployable in the legal job market, for the most part, virtually guaranteeing that most will cycle in and out of prison, sometimes for the rest of their lives. In this way, mass incarceration has decimated black families to a degree comparable to slavery. Now, this isn't a phenomenon that just affects some small segment of the African American community. To the contrary, in many large urban areas, more than half of working age African American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. Women, particularly black women and Latina women, are now catching up. Black and Latina women are the fastest growing segment of our prison population today, acquiring criminal records right along with the men. And once you get branded a criminal or a felon, you're ushered into an undercaste, stripped of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. You have become part of an undercaste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I find that when I tell people today that, you know, I think mass incarceration amounts to a new Jim Crow, a new caste-like system, I am frequently met with shock, disbelief. Standard reply is, well, how can you say that? I mean, just look at Barack Obama. No, just look at Oprah Winfrey. Just look at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. You know, just look at Herman Cain. See, you know, black people are doing well. Black people are doing well. Well, I think it's important for people to keep in mind that no caste system in the United States has ever governed all African Americans. There have always been free blacks and black success stories, even during slavery and Jim Crow. You know, during slavery, there were some black slave owners. Not many, but there were some. And during Jim Crow, there were some black lawyers and black doctors. Not many, but some. Now, the extraordinary nature of individual black achievement in formerly white domains today certainly does suggest that the old Jim Crow is dead. But it doesn't necessarily mean the end of racial caste. If history is any guide, it may have just taken a different form. I think any honest observer of American racial history has to acknowledge that the rules and reasons the legal system employs for enforcing status relations of any kind, they evolve and change as they're challenged. You know, in the first chapter of the book, I describe the cyclical rebirths of caste in America. Since our nation's founding, African Americans have repeatedly been controlled through institutions like slavery and Jim Crow, which appear to die, but then are reborn in new form, tailored to the needs and constraints of the time. For example, after slavery, A new system of control was born to replace slavery, known as convict leasing. After the Civil War, African American men were arrested en masse. It was our nation's first prison boom. They were arrested for extremely minor crimes like loitering or vagrancy, arrested, sent to prison, and then leased to plantations. Sometimes the very plantations they had been freed from or their parents had been freed from. Now, the idea was that they were supposed to earn their freedom, but the catch was they often could not earn enough to pay back the plantation owner the cost of their clothing, food, or shelter to the plantation owner's satisfaction, and so they were effectively re-enslaved, sometimes for the rest of their lives. Douglas Blackman has written an excellent book about one version of convict leasing in the South. His book is called Slavery by Another Name, about the rebirth of slavery in the United States following the Civil War. Well, I believe that our criminal justice system has been used once again in a manner that effectively recreates caste in America. Now, I know there's probably at least one person, maybe more out there, who's thinking, what's she talking about? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control, it's a system of crime control. And if black folks would stop running around committing so many crimes, they wouldn't have to worry about being locked up and then stripped of their basic civil and human rights. But therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's just not true. In a 30-year period of time, our prison population quintupled. Not doubled, not tripled, quintupled. We went from a prison population of about 300,000 to well over 2 million. But during this period of time, crime rates fluctuated. Went up, went down, went back up again, went down. Today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, crime rates are actually at historical lows nationwide. But incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime was going up or going down in any given community or the nation as a whole. So what explains the sudden explosion in incarceration in the United States, the birth of a penal system unprecedented in world history, if not crime and crime rates? Well, the answer is the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, the wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. Drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for about 2/3 of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000, the period of our prison system's most dramatic expansion. Drug convictions have increased more than 1,000% since the drug war began. I mean, to get a sense of how large a contribution the drug war has made to mass incarceration, consider this. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. Most do. But the enemy in this war has been racially defined. Not by accident, the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, or sell. Now, many people find that hard to believe. It defies our basic racial stereotypes about who drug dealers are. It defies everything that we've seen in the media about who the drug dealers are. A study was done in the mid-1990s, a national survey was done asking survey respondents to close your eyes and picture in your mind a drug criminal. 95% of respondents said they pictured African American. Only 5% pictured someone of any other race or ethnic group. When people think drug crime, they think black. But the reality is, the studies actually show that white youth may be more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. But that's not what you would guess by taking a peek inside our nation's prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. Now, I find that when people see the data, they say, oh, you know, that's bad. That's bad. That's a shame. But, you know, we need a drug war and a get tough approach with those people in the hood, because that's where the violent offenders are. That's where the drug kingpins are. In fact, in my experience, most people seem to imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities and the related violence. And for a while, I believed that too. But it's not true. It's not true. President Ronald Reagan declared his drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. He declared his drug war before, not after, crack began to ravage inner city communities and become a media sensation. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term, a war on drugs, but it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise, and less than 3% of the American population even identified drugs as nation's most pressing concern. So why declare a drug war at a time when drug crime is actually on the decline and the American public isn't much concerned about drugs? Well, from the outset, the war on drugs had relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug abuse or drug addiction, and nearly everything to do with politics, racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented that the war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded get tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare in order to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were anxious about, resentful of, fearful of many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Now, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that poor and working class whites really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. You know, wealthy white folks could send their kids to private schools, could give their kids all of the advantages that wealth has to offer. But poor and working class whites, many of whom were struggling for survival themselves, they faced a social demotion. Right? It was their kids who might get bussed across town to go to a school they believed was inferior. It was their kids and themselves who were suddenly forced to compete on equal terms for limited jobs with this whole new group of people they've been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them. And then to make matters worse from their perspective, affirmative action programs created the impression that black folks were now leapfrogging over them on their way to Harvard or Yale or fancy jobs in corporate America. And this state of affairs created an enormous amount of fear, anger, resentment, anxiety, but it also created an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group not so subtly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. It was part of the effort to flip the South from blue to red. So when President Reagan declared his drug war in 1982, it was an effort to make good on campaign promises to get tough on a group of people not so subtly defined by race. H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, explained the strategy this way, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. And so a couple years after the drug war was announced, crack hit the streets and began to ravage inner city communities, and the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, the so-called crack whores, and crack-related violence, all in an effort to turn crack into a media sensation, which they believed would bolster public support for a drug war they had already declared and persuade Congress to devote millions more dollars to waging it. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, our television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug users, crack babies, so-called crack whores. Some people in this room may be too young to remember this, but there was a time when our television sets were flooded with images about crack dealers and crack babies, and images of black men hauled into courtrooms about crack. And a wave of punitiveness swept over the United States. Congress passed harsh mandatory minimum sentences for minor drug crime, sentences harsher than murderers received in many other Western democracies. And soon, Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them than their Republican counterparts. And so it was President Bill Clinton who escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. And it was the Clinton administration that championed laws banning drug offenders from federal financial aid for schooling upon release, banning drug offenders as well as all people with criminal records from equal opportunity at public housing. It was the Clinton administration that championed laws banning drug offenders even from food stamps for the rest of their lives under federal law. To a large extent, so many of the rules, laws, policies, and practices that constitute the basic architecture of this new caste system were championed by a Democratic administration desperate to win back those so-called white swing voters, the Reagan Democrats, the folks who had defected from the Democratic Party in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement. And there were more than a few black politicians and black leaders who joined the Get Tough call. And I have found that many people will use this fact to prove that mass incarceration isn't about race. It's about crime, they say. They say this isn't about race because, look, there were black leaders calling for Get Tough. There were some black folks supporting the war on drugs and many of these tactics. But what often gets ignored is that's not all they were asking for. They were also asking for good schools, job creation, economic investment in these communities, because they were desperate and violence was raging in the wake of the crack epidemic. They also said, yeah, we need some police and we need to get tough because things have gotten out of hand. But what we have seen now over the years is that when black folks, poor folks in general, but especially poor folks of color, ask for good schools, they don't get them. If they ask for jobs, they don't get them. If they ask for economic investment, they don't get it. The only thing poor folks of color ask for and get are police and prisons. And so many black political leaders, faith leaders of all races, found themselves complicit in the birth of a vast new system of racial and social control. But still, many people say, well, we do have to get tough with them, those folks in those communities, because that is where the violence is. But what many people don't realize is that this drug war has never been aimed at rooting out the violent offenders or the drug kingpins. It has never been rooted at violent offenders primarily. No, federal funding in this war has flowed to state and local law enforcement agencies that boost their numbers, the sheer numbers of drug arrests. It's been a numbers game. Law enforcement has been rewarded in cash for the sheer numbers of people swept into the system for drug offenses, which helps to explain why so often law enforcement goes out looking for the so-called low-hanging fruit, stopping, frisking, searching as many people as possible in an effort to get their numbers up. It also helps to explain why the overwhelming majority of people arrested for drug offenses are arrested for very minor, nonviolent offenses. 4 out of 5 drug arrests for simple possession, only 1 out of 5 for sales. Most people in state prison have no history of violence or significant selling activity. And in the 1990s, the Clinton years, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. You know, a drug less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this drug war almost exclusively in the hood, we've created a vast new racial undercast in an astonishingly short period of time. Now, where has the U.S. Supreme Court been in all of this? Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has been busy eviscerating Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, giving the police license to stop, frisk, search just about anyone, anywhere, without a shred of evidence of criminal activity, no reasonable suspicion, no probable cause, as long as they get consent, which just means, yes, Your Honor, yes, officer, you can search me. People often ask, well, why don't you file a lawsuit to do something about this? What happened to the racial profiling cases? Why don't you file more of those? People don't realize is that it's not possible to file those kinds of racial profiling cases anymore. The U.S. Supreme Court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias in the criminal justice system at every stage of the process now, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. The court has ruled in a series of cases that it doesn't matter how overwhelming your statistical evidence is, doesn't matter how severe the racial disparities are, unless you offer proof of conscious intentional bias, tantamount to an admission by a police officer or prosecutor, you can't even state a claim for racial bias in the criminal justice system today. In this way, the U.S. Supreme Court has basically immunized this system of mass incarceration from judicial scrutiny for racial bias, much in the same way that it rallied to the defense of slavery and Jim Crow in their day. But of course, being swept into the system with little hope of challenging it is just the beginning, because once you're branded a criminal or felon, then you're ushered into a parallel social universe where your basic civil and human rights are stripped from you. You find that you may not be able to vote. You're deemed ineligible for jury service for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box on employment applications asking, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And it doesn't matter if that felony happened a few weeks ago, a few years ago, or 30 years ago. For the rest of your life, you're checking that box, I'm a felon, knowing that application is likely going straight to the trash. Hundreds of professional licenses are off limits to people convicted of felonies. People often say to me, oh, come on, these people can get jobs if they really try. You know, they could get a job bagging groceries, or they could get a job at Burger King, or, you know, getting a job bagging groceries, getting a job at Burger King, no easy feat. You have a felony record. People say, well, they should become entrepreneurs. They should start their own businesses then if they can't get, you know, a job elsewhere. In my state, in Ohio, you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been convicted of a felony. With that felony, you can find yourself locked out of public housing for the rest of your life. A young man turning home from prison wants to do right by his family, his kids, return home to his children. His partner, his spouse, living in public housing, wants to do right, return home. A woman returning from prison wanting to reunite her children, turning home, that whole family risks eviction just by allowing parent to come home to public housing in many places. Food stamps may be off limits to you here in California. You convicted of a drug offense, you may not even be eligible to get food assistance to survive. What do we expect folks to do? Can't get a job, barred from housing, even food, basic food, is off limits to you? Well, apparently what we expect them to do is to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. Paying all of this is often a condition of your probation or parole. In a growing number of states, you're actually expected to pay back the cost of your imprisonment. And then if you're one of the lucky few who actually manages to get a job upon release from prison, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished in some states. Up to 100% to pay back all those fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. What are folks expected to do? Say, what is this system designed to do? Seems designed to send folks right back to prison, which is what in fact happens the vast majority of time. About 70% of people released from prison return within a few years, and the majority of those who return in some states do so in a matter of months because the challenges associated with mere survival on the outside are so immense. So what do we do? What do we do now that we've created all of this? Well, my own view is that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. And if you doubt that such a movement is really necessary, that maybe something less will do, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement really kicked off, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. 4 out of 5. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Private prison companies would be forced to watch their profits vanish. We'd go bankrupt. This system is now so deeply rooted in our social, political, and economic structure, it's not going to just fade away. It's not going to just downsize out of sight without a major upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. Of course, there's many people today who say there's no hope of ending mass incarceration. Just as many were resigned to Jim Crow in the South, said, yeah, it's a shame, but that's just the way that it is. Today, I find that many people view the millions cycling in and out of our prisons and jails as just an unfortunate but inalterable fact of American life. But I know that Dr. King and Ella Baker and Sojourner Truth would not have been so easily deterred. So it's time for us to pick up the baton. We have got to be willing to continue the work and do the hard work of movement building on behalf of poor people of all colors. In 1968, Dr. King told advocates that the time had come to shift from a civil rights movement to a human rights movement. He said, meaningful equality cannot be achieved through civil rights alone. Without basic human rights, the right to work, the right to shelter, the right to a quality education, the right to food, without basic human rights, he said, civil rights are an empty promise. So in honor of Dr. King and all those who labored to end the old Jim Crow, I hope we will commit ourselves to building a human rights movement to end mass incarceration, a movement for education, not incarceration, for jobs, not jails, a movement to end all forms of discrimination against people labeled criminals, discrimination that denies them their basic human rights to work, to shelter, and to food. So what must we do to build this movement? What do we do? Well, first, we've got to begin by telling the truth, the whole truth. We have got to be willing to admit out loud that we as a nation have rebirthed a caste-like system in America. And we've got to be willing to tell this truth in our churches, in our places of worship, in our schools, in the reentry centers, inside prisons. We have got to begin telling this truth so that a great awakening can begin. But I find that many advocates today, even those who are very committed to criminal justice reform, say this is the wrong time to talk like that. They say we have a great moment of opportunity right now, but we'll ruin it by talking about race. Talking about race makes people angry. It polarizes the debate, they say. They say talking about movement building and trying to work towards a great upheaval that will shake the foundations of this system will scare people off. We've got to just stick to dollars and cents. Talk about how much cheaper it is to send a kid to college rather than to prison. We got to tell people how many tax dollars they'll save by closing these prisons down. Maybe we can get to movement building later. Maybe we can talk about those racial justice issues later. For now, let's just stick to the fiscal concerns, things that will win over the mainstream white swing voter. Well, I fear that is a dangerous path to tread. It's tempting, but it's a dangerous path to tread. Why? Because if we fail, really fail, to speak openly, honestly, courageously about the root cause of mass incarceration, a root cause that is not about crime or even crime rates, but the root cause being the failure to care, to really extend the same care, compassion, and concern to poor folks trapped in ghettos as one would extend to their neighbors, friends, loved ones on the other side of town. If we fail to deal with that, with our habit as a nation of demonizing and stigmatizing people along the lines of race and class, if we fail to deal with that, sweep it under the rug, imagine we can get around to that some other time. Even if we downsize this system somewhat, nothing will prevent the race to incarcerate from beginning again when we can afford to do so. If the only limiting principle is how much it costs to throw people away, nothing will prevent us again from engaging in another race to incarcerate when we can afford it, or whether a wave of violent crime makes people all worked up about those people again. My fear is that in the years to come, we'll see some downsizing, prison downsizing here in California and other states around the country, and criminal justice reformers will pat themselves on the back and say, yeah, we took advantage of that moment, job well done. We'll still have extraordinarily high rate of incarceration, a rate of incarceration unconscionable by world standards, but it'll be reduced somewhat. And then we'll move on to another issue, and we'll still have millions of people cycling in and out of our prisons and jails. Rather than staying for 10 years, they might stay for 5. Rather than staying for 5 years, they'll stay for 2. Rather than getting 2 years in prison, they'll get just felony probation. And then when they're released, they'll face the same discrimination, still be barred from housing, still denied basic human rights, still cycling in and out of this system. The caste system will remain intact. We can cut our prison population in half just by reducing the length of prison sentences by half, but we will not have disturbed this caste system. People will still be cycling in and out of prison, just staying for shorter periods of time. So if we want to do more than simply close a handful of prisons, if we want to do more than just prison downsizing, if we want to end this caste system, we are going to have to deal with how we got here, deal with the root cause of mass incarceration, and inspire genuine care, compassion, and concern for people who have too long been viewed as disposable. So we're going to have to start telling the truth. But of course, just a lot of talk isn't going to be enough. That's not going to do it. We're also going to have to get to work. So we have got to build an underground railroad for people returning home from prison. An underground railroad. Helping people make a genuine break for freedom. Providing them help finding jobs and housing, food, the support they need. Courageous people like Susan Burton have been doing this work for a long time.
Ohio State law professor Michelle Alexander, speaking in Dominguez Hills, California, about the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness. The event was recorded by Global Voices for Justice. And that concludes today's 5 o'clock shadow, which was produced with Thiago Brozo and engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. For further information, please contact theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.